Welcome to Get Up in the Cool, old-time music with Cameron DeWitt and friends. It's week three of Get Up in the Cool month. I've been saving some very special episodes in hope that you'll be moved to support the show. This week's guest is Dan Levinson. We recorded this at the Centralia Campout in Centralia, Washington. Get Up in the Cool is primarily funded by its listeners. Big thanks to everyone who's supporting the show on Patreon, and shout out to Eric Schweizer, Al Ray, and Chris Hale for signing up last week. It means a lot. This podcast takes a lot of resources to make, more than I have. I can't do it without your help. For those of you who are thinking about supporting the show, thank you. You should know that Patreon supporters get special rewards for helping out, like access to a full video of this episode and many others. Then there's the Secret Bonus Track podcast featuring an extra tune per episode, and you can get access to the entire Get Up in the Cool tune archive with upwards of 50 hours of music, which is great for anyone who wants to go back and listen to the specific tunes without combing through the whole interview. But the rewards are just a thank you. What you're really getting for donating to Get Up in the Cool is the continued existence of the show. I really can't do it without you. So go now, while you're listening to this, to patreon.com/getupinthecool or follow the link in the show notes on your podcast app and choose a per-episode support level that you can sustain, because small sustaining donations are much more helpful than large short-term donations. Thank you to everyone who signs up, and thanks everyone who's still supporting the show after all these years. Don't go anywhere after the interview, because I want to tell you how to keep up with this week's guest. Let's get started. Here's my interview and jam with Dan Levinson. Enjoy. for money.
Yeah.
Dan Levinson, welcome to Get Up in the Cool.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for welcoming me into your temporary home.
Our temporary home.
Yeah. We're at the Centralia campout.
Old-time campout.
This is my first time here. It is not your first time here.
Third time. I haven't been here a lot of times.
Yeah. You live in Arizona, correct?
Tucson,
Arizona.
Tucson is home now.
Yeah. Is it a coincidence that you've come up north in August?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I've been probably more than 10 years in the Tucson area, 5 years. I think I was in Yuma for some of that. But I would travel in the summers, head east for years, and then travel west in the winters to follow the weather. But when I ended up staying in Tucson, I kind of mostly acclimated it. But it is nicer.
Yeah.
But that's the big, it is nicer to be up in the cooler area. Yeah. Last year, Albert, was still in the hundreds here. Even up here in Centralia, Washington.
Yeah.
So you didn't escape it.
Right.
But we try.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's a chance to get back into the green.
Yeah.
And see an event like this, you see so many friends and so many people from so many places. And I used to go back east every summer, or most summers. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a next step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
But I won't totally rule out your hypothesis.
Yeah.
Has some merit.
Yeah. I'm sure it helps that there is a week-long old-time festival out here.
Yeah, it does. But Emmy and I, my partner and I, have started traveling about a month or two in the summer.
Yeah.
So we came up here, we got here about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's just, bike ride, hike. You can do all this stuff outside. And that's the trick.
Without dying.
Can't do that in Tucson in the summer. So.
Yeah.
It was about 108 the week we left.
Yeah, that's so terrible. How awful. Well, I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad we're here, too. I'm glad I'm here, too.
Yeah. I'm sure Tucson, Arizona is gorgeous the rest of the year and lovely to be in. I've never been there. I can only assume.
You should come down.
Okay.
And in all serious, all joking aside, it's a beautiful part of the state, a beautiful part of the desert. I think it's one of the most lush deserts in the world. And the green and the flowers and stuff, even from the cactus, you would be shocked.
Mm.
And all summer long, all winter, every season has something really cool and special.
Mm.
But it's definitely, I enjoy the variety. So,
when you first started coming here, were you doing workshops every day like you are this year?
Yeah, that's how I started. I was talking about coming at one point, and Ray and Barb, who run it, said, I'd really like to have these kind of workshops. Would you be willing to do them? And, we'll let people donate and whatever, and I'll put my trailer up for you so you don't have to worry about anything. And, and it was just, sure, why not? And it's been great. So now I've done it every year.
Very cool.
And it just, people love it.
Now, you've been teaching this music for a really long time now.
A really long time. I probably started even teaching guitar when I was a teenager.
Yeah. Were you teaching old-time guitar as a teenager?
It's hard to really answer that in some ways because I think we've changed the meaning of the term. I was raised with what we now call old-time music. I mean, my mom played guitar, and they had a folk group that met at the house and sang songs. It was northern edge of southern Appalachia.
Yeah.
My dad called square dances. The public schools, grade schools, we had music every day.
Yeah.
We had singing, Little Wheel Turning in My Heart, in second, third grade. These are tunes that you think of now as, those were, old-time country church tunes. But they weren't. It was a normal part of my life, always. My parents met at a square dance, for instance.
Yeah.
And
so it's very literally like a part of your biology.
Yes. Yes. Very much. I mean, even to ending up having found myself making the majority of my living as a musician.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried all kind of. I've worked, towed cars when I was a kid. Worked in the gas station like anybody, trying to make money. Babysat. Went to school. I've got two master's degrees. in public administration and social work administration. It's like, and every time I turned around, the music was coming back in. And finally, I just ended up playing music more than anything else. So, and just, so yeah, it's a life. It's a lifestyle. So,
I think when I first heard your name, it was a friend of mine in Philly who wanted to learn how to play clawhammer banjo.
Okay.
And he had at least one of your books. I don't know necessarily how many clawhammer books you have.
Clawhammer.
I think
books.
It was like a method book.
Yeah, clawhammer banjo from scratch.
That was it.
A guide to the clawless.
Yeah, when. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and that's an apt subtitle too, because I think a lot of people's experience of the technique is, what is this? I can't get my body to do it, you know, and just profoundly not understanding what's going on mechanically. When did you write that?
99, 2000, somewhere around there, 98 maybe. And it was very much a result of exactly what your friend was talking about. It's like, you'd watch what people say, or you listen to what they say, and you watch what they're doing, and it's like, what they're doing made no sense compared to what they were saying.
Yes.
And there were a couple players who I really thought, you know, these guys get it, and I paid attention to what they did, you know. And I mean, when I was starting to play, you know, your hands get sore and everything gets stiff, and it's like, I thought, this has got to be wrong. There's something wrong here. Yeah. And I started to look at body mechanics and all that stuff. And I'm really not usually an analytical type of person. I mean, I run stuff through my mind, but I'd never be a good scientist. I just wouldn't. But I kept and sort of reverse engineered everything to what I saw and felt once I finally got it.
Yeah.
And the other thing I noticed, well, two other things I noticed. One is that you'd go to workshops and say, well, what am I doing? And this one guy said, I don't know, but it sounds okay, keep doing it. It's like, yeah, it was never any help.
Yeah, yeah.
And
too encouraging.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, just hit it harder. You know, it's the hammer dulcimer crowd. And it's like, well, it can't sound bad. Well, yeah, it can.
Yeah, absolutely can.
So I started going back and like I said, sort of reverse engineering it. And the books that were out there, even beginner books, weren't really beginner books. So,
What do you mean by that? Like, were they taking certain ideas for granted?
Or? Yeah, a lot of them. A lot, you know, like, you know, put your finger down at the second fret. Well, somebody who's never played music, well,
they're
going to
put it directly.
Fret?
Yeah, if they
well,
know
what's
what
a fret. Yeah, they don't even know what a fret is. It's like, so I went back with that in mind.
Yeah.
If you're talking to someone who's never played anything before.
Yeah.
And in the process of all that, I had been doing a workshop called Meet the Banjo. And Deering Banjos had given me 15 banjos to take, so I brought the banjo.
Okay.
So I could teach, do a workshop for people who had no experience, maybe had never touched any musical instrument at all. So that gave me a whole different view on watching people learn.
Yeah.
And making it make sense to them. So it was some interaction there, and I really wanted the book to be, from the beginning, methodical for most people, because most people follow a linear train of thought.
Sure.
You know, it's how we were taught.
Yeah.
And teach the basic tunes you're used to hearing, not the tunes there. So it starts, for instance, in double C and goes quickly to double D because it's so many D tunes.
Sure.
Instead of starting a G with something nobody plays.
Yeah.
You know.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So then that's been a lot of work. It was a lot of work, but it was worth it. And that's still kind of my favorite book. But I think I have 14 books now with Mel Bay.
Yeah.
Four of them are fiddle. But yeah.
So you have guides for the not completely clawless through thoroughly...
So you've got all the basic, build the tune from the very most basic, and it's the double thumb step to start, not the bum ditty, which kind of...
That makes so much sense. Because so much of the playing is double thumbing.
In the style we're playing, absolutely. It's a double thumbing, drop thumbing style, which is double thumbing. And to learn one and then have to have gone back... And that's when I finally discovered that. I was like, oh, well, of course, this makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So it starts right there. But then there's tune books, and the tune books themselves, they vary. One of the editors at Mel Bay came up with the idea, so why don't you write multiple staffs? One, include standard notation, so there's a standard music line. And two, a beginner and an advanced version of the tablature for the banjo. So that was the other, to give you more breakdown and more variation.
Interesting. So you put there's multiple staves, and you put them right next to each other so you can really...
Stacked.
Yeah.
Just like in an orchestra score. You can compare them. You can take these measures and mix it with these measures. And, and then you have a standard notation line.
That's wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And then the standard notation line gave the melody player something to follow that it's based on.
Yeah.
So great. And then there's fiddle versions of the same books. So they have the same basic line, but then they have an advanced fiddle line, and I think some of them had a mandolin tab line. And those are more your modern, or more, not modern, but the repertoires. One tune's got 100 plus tunes in it, the other's got 60 some tunes. And then all the way up to the more recent, which was these more convoluted, crazy tunes. And, odd versions of stuff like this one, like Get Off Your Money and things are in it. So
this one's in one of the books?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's in Beyond the Waterfall.
Beyond the Waterfall.
Yeah, so, everybody gets tired of Over the Waterfall, really, because this is the tune's perfect, Beyond the Waterfall. Yeah.
That was the first tune I learned.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the one I use is Spotted Pony. I got that because both Dolores Hagee and Ron Buchanan in Pittsburgh, those were their beginner tunes for their students.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is perfect. So,
Shout out to Ron.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know Dolores.
Oh, Dolores is great. Dolores was the choreographer for the Coal Country Cloggers.
Oh, wow. Because
I danced with the Coal Country Cloggers for 2 years.
You say you danced with them? So you dance as well?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Very good.
So, yeah.
What, this tune that we played first, Get Off Your Money, where did you buy that tune?
I think I first heard it from Jonathan Beckoff and Dirk Powell and Megan, whose last name. It was cassette. It's like this cassette of sea tunes. And I know for your people who don't know what cassettes were, they were those little reel-to-reels inside the plastic box that nobody plays with anymore.
Yeah.
they were wonderful for us. It's like portable music. Well, I want to think it's a Doc Roberts tune, but I'm not going to swear to that. I'd have to look it up to be sure. So.
And in my experience listening to John Beckoff, it may be originally someone else's, but by the time he's done with it, it's his.
Oh, no. I think it's Stripling Brothers, and he stays pretty true to
it. Interesting.
He really does. Or at least the things I've heard on over the years, the stuff that I've gotten has been, he's pretty true to the source. But... I take liberties. I mean, you can tell.
Yeah.
I think everybody did.
Sure.
And does. So, yeah. But yeah, his stuff was amazing. And John, Dirk was up in Cleveland or from Cleveland, so I got to see and play with him when I got serious about it. So, winding way back to what you asked, this has been sort of a lifelong music for me, but at the same time, as I've taken different steps and been in different towns and exposed to different people, what we now call old time is a refinement or it's a bad word, a sort of constrained version of old time.
Interesting. Because originally you weren't necessarily using that language to
describe that term,
all of the music.
No.
You were these are a bunch music of different traditions.
It's just music, and we listen to old time, what we call old time, folk, technically some of it's religious music, and my dad listened to bagpipes, and I played classical and listened to classical music, and everything, and then it was the late 50s, early 60s, and that's... In the old country area, they call it, we're going to have a sing if you go to Arkansas. And here it was like, we're going to have a hoot or a folk, a song circle at our home. And they were in my house.
Yeah.
That was part of my upbringing. So, but, refining it, getting to meet people like Dirk Powell, who'd really investigated it and gone in very specific areas. Kevin Enoch, I worked with Kevin Enoch, probably in my formative old time period, I was in Cleveland, Ohio. Well, that's David Bass, it's Dirk Powell, it's Reese Jones, Mark Olitski. We became part of it, but at the same time, all these people were just there.
Yeah.
So, normal crowd, very cool stuff. So,
What should we play next?
Why don't we do that Cat Came Back? That is Doc Rogers. In G, right?
Yeah, let me get to G. It still sounds good.
It's old time music, right?
Yeah.
So Cat Came Back. This is Doc Rogers. Stop on the right part?
Yeah. We stopped on the part you wanted to stop on, which is the right one.
Oh, well, okay. Until the next time.
When did you start playing fiddle? When did fiddle come into the picture?
The second time, I probably had been playing banjo about 5 years when I bought, 4 or 5 years when I bought this fiddle, probably. But in grade school, I started learning violin.
Oh, yeah. How come? Was there like a strings program?
There was an orchestra. This is grade school, but for instance, in grade school, I sang in the choir and there was an orchestra and I think there was a band.
Great.
By high school, there were 5 orchestras, 5 bands, 5 choirs, plus a marching band and a concert band in the public school program.
In Pittsburgh?
In Pittsburgh.
And were you, how many of those were you a part of?
By the high school and after grade school, just the orchestra.
Just the orchestra.
Just the orchestra. Hmm. But the director of the Pittsburgh Public Music Program was Stanley Levin. I looked like Salvador Dali. It's great. I have a photograph of me. mustache and all. He was a friend of my parents. And I was taking piano in second grade because they gave piano lessons at school, group piano lessons.
Oh.
But our piano was, it was old, it was worn out. My parents went to have it tuned.
Yeah.
Found out the sounding board was cracked, and they couldn't afford to change it. But they really wanted me to be able to have, you know, some musical thing going on. So they took me to Stanley's office. Hmm. Stanley's office, to me, it seemed like the size of a gymnasium. It probably wasn't all that big.
Yeah.
But he had, you know, he had grand piano in there. He had kettle drums. He had clarinets, flutes. He had, like, basically every instrument in the orchestra. And he let me try them all. And in my mind, I remember it being down to deciding, trying to decide between violin and trumpet. When I guess Stanley looked at my mom and said, "This will be a violinist."
Hmm.
So it was picked.
Yeah.
You know, and conveniently we had a cousin neighbor down the road who had an old violin that they got for me and had it repaired, fixed up. And I just started taking lessons from one of the retired symphony violinists. And by high school, I was playing guitar also, because, you know, we all wanted to play guitar in
sure.
the 60s.
Yeah.
The deal was I had to play violin for a year before I could have the guitar.
Yeah,
but then they got me the guitar. Yeah, that was reward. You remember the Stella Harmonies, you know, with the neck
yes.
like this? Yeah, I had one of those.
I also had a bad first guitar.
Yeah, it ended its first year of me learning to play in a campfire up in outside of Woodstock, New York somewhere.
Yeah.
But we didn't know the festival was going to happen. But so I stuck with violin and self-taught guitar pretty much through junior, senior year of high school, and I just dropped it. I just had enough.
Yeah.
So slipped guitar through college and then kept trying. I tried banjo several times, and books didn't work, nothing worked. And
what kind of banjo music did you want to play back then?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, you know, I was like, I'm like everybody else who knew there was a difference.
Sure.
It's just a banjo.
Yeah.
And probably the most direct influence would be people like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie
sure.
and the Limelighters and the Kingston Trio, people like that. So they were playing what we now call folk music.
Yes.
Okay. And nothing wrong with that. Seeger had a dramatically up-picked style, but he wrote the book, which in his words, even if you read his biographies, he talks about, he said, you know, Mike should have written the book, not him. But they, you know, they had him write this book
yeah.
that we all see as a first clawhammer book, but it wasn't.
No,
it had some clawhammer technique, but he was an up picker. He was really a finger style finger picker when it came down to it. But I had that book, and I tried the Pete Wernick book at one point, you know, for bluegrass styles. And I thought, you know, my dad listened to bluegrass. We used to go down to college and listen to bluegrass in the bars too. Mac Martin and Dixie Travelers were playing every week, and it just didn't really work. None of it really worked. And then somewhere, I gotta guess around mid '80s, or maybe it had to be before that, because like I said, I was in Pittsburgh. They started the dances back up. Cold Country Traditions, Dolores Nat Kraut started the dances. Traditional square dances, not the club style, not where you had to go and learn lessons and everything, just
yeah.
and not the fire hall style, which was a little more different type of tradition. But this community, everything's taught, everything's walked through, very simple. I started going back again. That would have to be, my younger boy was not quite two. He was born in 81, so probably 81, 82. That's fairly late when you think about it. Started going back to dances with him and playing guitar back up, and then folk festivals and going to some of the things like that. And it still was kind of hit and miss, but I ended up working at, you know, getting recordings, listening to people, and then I had somebody gave me tapes. I was living in Rochester, New York for about a year or so, and started hanging around with some more old-time people when I said something about great bluegrass, and somebody looked at me and said, no, that's old-time. Yeah, you know, yeah. It's like, oh, okay, so the difference is here. And, you know, we're talking about what's old-time. Well, old-time, when you start to really look into it, old-time's whatever the generation or so before played in whatever region you lived in.
Yeah.
So if you go up to northern Michigan, old-time is heavily French-Canadian influenced. Yeah. And if you go to, you know, Arizona or places like that, and you get the traditional, what they call old-time would be much more conjunto and Mexican and Spanish influenced music. But the old time we are talking about, I started working in a field that started taking me down to the festivals, and banjos were on the wall, and I was listening. I mean literally bought pretty much anything I could get my hands on, and being at the store where I did the ordering, I could order anything out of the catalogs. So spent about 5 years from that point on, mid-80s, just listening to nothing but old vintage recordings of the old-time bands.
Yeah.
So, but banjo came in probably about 3 or 4 years into that.
Yes.
Or fiddle, rather. Sorry, backwards.
Okay.
I was playing banjo, and when I went there, I ordered a good banjo. I was really starting to make headway, and I thought, okay, I can go back and do this again.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, this fiddle from Clifford and started figuring it out.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Clifford rescued this piece of wood from a stump, from a firewood pile.
Clifford who?
Clifford Hardison. Okay. Died about 8 years ago. He was 86 or 87 when he passed away. He made almost a little more than 200 fiddles over his life.
Yeah.
I have three of them now. So.
Yeah.
But, and then somewhere along the line, you know, fiddle took over from banjo. And I played more fiddle than banjo. And current band doesn't actually have a full-time banjo player. We have two fiddles, a guitar and bass, and the Cat Mountain Rounders, them, and when we do some of the songs, I switch to banjo, so I get to play again. Way fun.
So there'll be a link in the show notes for auditions for the new banjo player.
Great. They go to that site that says, no thanks.
Yeah.
No thanks. You've seen that picture, right?
Yeah.
It looks great. Five tabs are missing.
Yeah.
No, it just, and it's really funny. I mean, the funny part of it is it's a banjo player. Who cares? But I was a banjo player, and I am a banjo player.
Yeah.
And I love the instrument. I love the music. But something about the current configuration with just the two fiddles and the bass and guitar, it just really has become my focus now.
Yeah.
So. We'll be doing here at Centralia, we'll be doing Thursday afternoon, we'll be doing a little concert set, and we'll have the banjo player that plays with us now and then up a bit. So
great.
But
let me get to D so we can play this Cuckoo's Nest.
Cool. Okay, let's try this one. Sort of a convoluted combination of probably Morgan Sellier, Ed Haley, Ed Haley and John Hartford and people I've heard play it over the years, and whatever insanity I've done to it.
Oh, very good. So this is your Cuckoo's Nest.
I guess.
By this point.
By this point, cool. Probably is. And, you know, people, what somebody said last night, so you want to play that strange version of Cuckoo's Nest you play?
Yeah.
Dan's version of Cuckoo's Nest. But I pretty much tip off to, you know, if you listen to Ed Haley, and you listen to John Hartford's, you know, extrapolation from it. I like to think that's where a lot of it comes from. So, but
who's to say?
Who's to say?
Yeah.
I'll take the blame. I can handle. Thank you. Thank you.
I love it.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I think Dave Malefsky has a lot to do with that version somehow from years and years ago. He was a, I guess he was a Virginia Philly, a generation before. But he had these very wonderful, convoluted versions of some, you know, crooked versions of straight tunes, and straight versions of crooked tunes, and I think some of those notes probably come from him too.
Sure.
So yeah, if he's still around, I have no idea.
So you said that most of your living over the years has come through music, but I feel like we've just barely started talking about like performing.
Okay.
When did like performing, heavy quotes, this music start?
Probably when I was at the music store in Cleveland, when I was really starting to work, and I played with the boss and his wife, and had a lady played bass for us, and then Dave Rice worked there also. Yeah, you might know him from any number of bands, Hoover Uprights for one, and he was harmonica player for me in the Boiled Buzzards. So the early Boiled Buzzards album was me and Dave, the same bass player, a lady who played bass with us, and we had various guitar players. There's like four albums and no two have the same configuration. So.
Yeah.
But that's kind of old-time bands, I guess,
sure,
isn't it? So we did harmonica for a couple years. And that's I think the first recording we actually made, a recording in 89. And it started us doing festivals. We were doing dances. I mean, the first dance I played, I think on banjo, I think I had 13 tunes, and we hoped the hell they didn't have more, you know, that were ready to take out. And it's like, oh God.
Did they make you do medleys?
We didn't do medleys.
Okay,
you know,
cool, that works.
You know, well, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, the medleys and the stuff, it's all contra dances now.
Yeah.
And it used to, even when I was still in Pittsburgh, they came and called a contra and people booed.
Interesting.
It was 100% squares.
Huh.
And as long as the tune had an even number of beats, they didn't care.
Yeah, it's kind of flipped now, huh?
It's entirely flipped. And now it's all contras. And, you know, we play a lot. Yeah, I still play a lot of them. It's still great. It's the same people. But, you know, side story, you know, Ron Buchanan started writing contra dances with square dance moves, I think partly to get people interested in the contras, and vice versa, putting contra dance moves into his square dances that he wrote to try and familiarize them.
Yeah.
But it literally switched to me overnight.
Huh.
It was really weird. But Price started that bit of it, and, you know, the short version is when you're working in the music store and people call and you're performing and everything else, sooner or later, you're going to end up wanting to take a gig when your boss wants you to work, and it's like, he owned the store, I wanted to take the gig. We got hired to do a fashion show for the United Colors of Benetton in Cleveland.
Wow.
It was fun. But they were having all these international acts, so it was like three tunes with this, three tunes with that. It was very cool, but it was like, you got to work that night. It's like, no man, I told you I wasn't going to be here. It's like, I got a gig. It's like, next day it was like, you don't work here anymore. It's like, yeah, that's cool. You know, you own the company. you get to decide. So, and I spent a certain amount of time. I took a job managing a coffee house, one of the biggest coffee houses in Cleveland, and learning that business well. But then they had me hiring the music for the coffee house. And same thing, you know, I had gigs and it just didn't work out for very long. I spent about a year. I loved it, but it was just, the more and more, so I say, I found myself playing one day more than working.
Yeah.
And, you know, you take the gigs and you go on it, and writing the books. I had written a first book. Bill Bay saw it. Mel Bay's son, you know, who runs a company still, saw it at Winfield. He said, I want anything you print. So I was ready. I started teaching a little bit. And, you know, that's become everything.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's, I haven't heard a lot of people who have just sort of, their story is they fell into it.
Yeah.
Professionally. Yeah. A lot of people fall into the music, but falling into like, I guess I'm doing this more than
Well, and
social work or whatever
right,
it is.
Right, yeah, it's like whatever. I ended up in retail, you know, doing retail. I was doing camera equipment for a bunch of years and going to more festivals, and then moved to Cleveland to run a shop that built banjos and sold. We had the largest collection of traditional, you know, folk and traditional music in probably in the country. Huh. People would come up from Nashville to shop my record collections to buy, and it was records. It was LPs, you know. There were no CDs. They didn't exist yet. Cassettes were popular, but it just, I mean, I just, you know, there's a religious undertone to a lot of stuff that people talk about. I'm not a religiously observant person. I was raised with, you know, with religious traditions, but almost all of them sort of have some version of freedom choice. You have a choice on what you, you know.
Sure.
I said, and one day I said, there's this, you know, even if we were given a choice, it doesn't say that was supposed to change where we're going to end up.
Yeah.
it's like this, I won't go so existential as to say the path was predetermined, but it just seems like everything I've done sort of took me further and further along that path, whether it was taking my guitar and singing a Dylan song in high school for a social studies class and getting an A from that, or I think one year as graduate level administrative theory courses in Cat's Cradle, you know, Harry Chapin's Cat's Cradle is in one of the textbooks.
Yeah.
He had to do a presentation. Well, hell, you know, I could still take the guitar in and do it. Or Johnny Mitchell's Circle Game for the Stages of Life. It's like, use what you have. And this is what I found myself doing. If I've got, and I've always been a little more business-like at it than a lot of people, because that just seemed to me sensible, you know, you're right. And because it's, you know, you're making you know, the higher it's higher politics of smaller dollars, and you just have to be efficient at it. But for instance, this year just nothing has worked out.
Yeah.
Almost nothing. I mean, this is, you know, what we're doing is great. Mm-hmm. And I've got my stuff. I'm at a different stage. I'm waiting for the next thing, so learning. But I had, you know, 3-4 different workshops and performances that were supposed to happen in July up in this region, and not a one of them's panned out.
Huh.
But yet, so laying back, you know. It's the same with music. You have to sort of, at some point, you can read all you want. I have nothing against written music. I write. I mean, written music goes way back. You know, the McFarlane collections that were being done, the transcriptions of fiddle tunes, everybody thinking, oh, you shouldn't read music. I said, oh, they've been doing it forever.
Yeah.
But at some point, you have to let back and see what comes out.
Yeah.
So Cuckoo's Nest, you know, that's what's come out.
Yeah.
And Ray lays back and lets this event be what it's going to be.
Yeah.
I got this wonderful opportunity to do these repertoire workshops and whatever I want to do. He kind of says, yeah, sure, let's do it. And people react to it, and it's great. And there's no guarantees, and there's no contracts, and it's just the next thing will find its way.
Yeah, so, that's beautiful.
It's great.
That's encouraging for me to hear as someone who's pretty recently gone into being self-employed with music.
And it's scary. It's terrifying. And you know what? In one hand, that'll never go away.
Yeah.
And the other side, that keeps you alive.
Yeah.
But now it's... I can probably identify... I can't tell you what year at the moment. I know where I was. Where I've been playing for, you know, with people, hired for recordings, doing a little of this, doing a little of that. And everything had pretty much been left to the music. And I was in my trailer at a night at a camper at a Dulcimer Festival, Hammer Dulcimer Music, big music festival in Everett, Michigan. And these groups outside jamming outside of the tent. Beautiful music. And I know that's when I sat there and I said, you know, it's different now.
Mm.
They're having a good time and I enjoy what I do, but it's what I do now.
Yeah.
It's different. It's still fun, but you're now working all the time.
Yeah.
When you go to an event.
Yeah.
It's still fun, but it's different.
Well, fortunately for me, I'm not someone who thrives with a lot of freedom, so mm-hmm. it's actually really helpful for me to have something to do at these
things. Yeah, well, that's what I felt, too. It's like, okay, I set up my, you know, I end up, I was vending at Clifftop, because you got to sell what you get. And I loved having this one place, and everybody came to you and visited, and we had a. I still love it. I mean, don't let any of this give you the wrong idea, and being able to sit and do what we're doing right now, this is fabulous. Yeah. This is great. It is. You know, so. We should play another tune.
Yeah, let me get to A.
What do we have? You're going to go to A? Oh, I can switch fiddles here. It's okay.
Yeah?
It's resonating right. Yeah, this can be on the record. Brian Bowers came and did an auto harp workshop. You know Brian Bowers? You know who he is?
No.
He actually lives up around Seattle. He was in Sidra Woolley last I remember. Brian Bowers is just this incredible auto harp player. He plays with people like Norman Blake, and you know, he's the Norman Blake of the auto harp. And he came and did a workshop at the store I was running.
This one in Cleveland?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He has, first of all, all his harps are diatonic. They're not chromatic harps, they're diatonic harps, I think, because they only play out of one or two keys. And he did a tuning section with the workshop. Yeah. And he showed everybody how to properly tune in the case of an auto. You got a lot of strings here. He said the first time he goes over the instrument, he tunes the notes to the tuner.
Yes.
To make them...
In the ballpark.
In the ballpark, but numerically, frequency... I'm blanking on a word here. But correct according to the frequency of the note.
Sure.
He said, then I go through and I tune and sweeten... to use your term, adjust the notes by ear until it sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I play it by the chords and adjust the chords.
Yeah.
Which, since his instruments play in a specific key, retunes the chords.
Interesting.
So if you play guitar, or even with the banjo, once you get the notes right, you play your chord progression of the key you want to play in, and you will find you'll probably change something. So once I tune the instruments, you're like, you'll see, I'll tune the individual notes. And then I'll... chord it, because it's going to change the harmonics and the resonance of the according to the instrument, according to the strings you're using, according to the air pressure and everything else. And that's the technical, but it just... until it sounds right.
Yeah.
And that takes some time to develop, but most people can do it faster than they think.
Mm.
But that's why something just always sounds a little off, so something perfectly tuned to a machine.
Interesting.
But that's part of it.
Cool.
It's key specific.
Yeah.
So, but we're in A now?
Yeah. It's super A.
Tipping back the corn.
Yeah.
Thank you.
back the corn.
So where do people go to buy your instructional materials and your recorded works, etc.?
Okay.
Hire you to play at your dances?
I have a website. It's www.clawdan.com.
Great.
As simple as it can be.
Yeah.
I took that name when I started with when Banjo Hangout started, and it just serves me well.
Yeah.
Fiddle Dan was taken, and yeah. I wasn't much of a fiddler then anyway. But yeah, they can get my recordings. I've got, I think I've got 8 recordings out at the moment, working on one with my current band. But you can hear the new band on free downloads from the website. Books, history, there's a couple of articles that I've written over the years, and it's been fun. So how to hire me, where to hire me, you know.
Yeah, it's all there.
It's all there. Schedule's probably out of date at the moment. I got to get it up to date. I have a very busy fall and winter probably coming up already. So booking next winter, next summer now, rather.
Great. Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking a little bit of your already fairly structured festival time and giving it a little more.
This is the unstructured festival. This is the fun fest.
Yeah.
And you know, in regards to that, I started an event down in Tucson, very similar to this, called the Southwest Old Time String Band Gathering.
Cool.
And SWOTGathering.com.
Yeah.
Reasonable fee. You can get them in Thursday afternoon, stay till Sunday afternoon. Nothing is scheduled, nothing is planned. Just come play music, eat, and we have a couple dances, we have a potluck. But
perfect.
You know, just come and hang out and enjoy music just like here.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So, should we do one more?
Yeah.
Let's do one more. How about Sandy Boys?
Sandy Boys.
Ed and Hammett Sandy Boys.
Yeah.
Parts in his order.
Yeah.
I do like to find the oldest versions of things I can find.
Yeah.
And I tell my classes all the time, you know, listen, you have to find all these versions. And then what comes out is going to come out,
yeah.
But I want to know it was from somewhere particular. So this is mostly from the playing of Ed and Hammonds, and then, of course, like you said, stuff comes out, it's going to happen, I do what I do.
From the playing of Dan Levinson.
And your own self on that banjo is pretty damn cool.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Visit Dan's website for his many albums, books, articles, and performance dates, and you can book him there too, if that's something that you do. You can also contact him on his website for lessons in Tucson or anywhere via Skype. Just follow the link in the show notes on your podcast to clawdan.com. Also linked in the show notes is patreon.com/getupinthecool, the best way to support the show, especially during Get Up in the Cool month. Remember, the show needs small, sustaining donations, so if you enjoy the show and can afford it, please chip in. That's all for now, friends. Thanks for listening. Come back same time next week to Get Up in the Cool.